Thank you, Ephraim. Can everyone hear me? Is this a good level? All right. Oh, thanks, and I'm very happy to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit today about the system that I like to study and some experiments that I did with it while I was on sabbatical from Bates College, collaborating with a group of Ronald Hansen at TU Delft. Now, this red arrow that might look a little like my computer cursor is meant to represent the system that we're studying. It's a single optically active defect in diamond that has a spin degree of freedom that can remain coherent over sufficiently long timescales that you can start to think about doing interesting things with it in metrology or in quantum information science. Now, optically active defects, or color centers in diamond, have an extremely long history. But there's been a resurgence of interest in them in recent years for a variety of reasons. And I wanted to start by giving you a kind of overview of the kinds of things that people are doing with diamond-based devices. Some of the interest in diamond defect centers has been spurred by their optical properties. Unlike some quantum dots or dime molecules, the fluorescence from diamond defects can be extremely stable. They don't blink and they don't bleach, which makes them attractive candidates for single photon sources or for fluorescence markers in biological imaging. Their optical transitions are even compatible with a type of optical meniscopy. What you're seeing here in this image is a combination of a diffraction-limited confocal spot showing the fluorescence from a single emitter, together with, I hope you can see it in this light, that tiny red spot in the middle is a far-field optical meniscopy image of a defect center in diamond imaged with 6 nanometer resolution. So there's really a lot of opportunities to make optical devices with defects. But the defects that I study also have a spin degree of freedom. And that spin degree of freedom comes into play in devices that use it to sense fields, be they electric fields, magnetic fields, or even temperature. Whenever you have a field that changes the splitting of this spin, you can use it to measure that field. And one of the exciting things about using defects to measure fields is that they can really bring you to an unprecedented range of field sensitivity and spatial resolution, because the defects themselves are localized to within a few lattice sites. This image that I'm showing you here, it comes from Jörg Buckstrup's group in Stuttgart, where they mounted a nanocrystal of diamond at the tip of an atomic force microscope. And very recently, Amir Jacobi's group used a similar device to image magnetic domains using spins inside that diamond nanocrystal with 25 nanometer resolution. But the experiments that I'd like to tell you about today really fit within a different type of application for diamond defects, that is, in quantum information science, where the spin degree of freedom represents a physical platform in which you could think about encoding quantum information, and that also can be used as a handle to access other spins in the diamond lattice, for example, nuclear spins. So you'd have a set of quantum bits associated with a defect. And its optical transitions provide a mechanism by which you can think about linking these defects into a quantum network for computation or communication applications. So really, my interests have centered around quantum information science, and that's why I got into studying ND defects in the first place. So where do these defects fit in the context of quantum information science? Well, painting this field with extremely broad brushstrokes, you can create a spectrum from the extremely coherent types of systems that people are studying with atoms or trapped ions or liquid state NMR. These types of systems can exhibit coherence times that are measured in seconds, minutes, even hours in some cases. But that long coherence time often comes at the cost of interacting fairly weakly with each other and with controls, making it difficult to do fast operations with these devices and to scale them up to larger systems. At the other end of the spectrum, I would put the solid-state devices, superconducting quantum bits, quantum dots, where you can integrate optical and electronic controls using advanced nanofabrication techniques, but typically qubits in these systems only retain their quantum mechanical properties over microseconds or even nanoseconds. So in this broad spectrum, the diamond defects that I study really fit somewhere in the middle, bridging the gap between the extremely coherent atomic systems and the more controllable solid-state ones. Hopefully, I can show to you some of the things we can do with them. We can't quite get to the same coherence times as atoms, but we approach them. And it's possible to fabricate integrated controls and optics to perform gates on them on relatively fast timescales. And much like atomic systems, the defect that I study has optical transitions. So with that introduction, let me plunge in to introducing you to one of my favorite defects, probably the most studied defect in diamond, the nitrogen vacancy center. As its name might suggest, the nitrogen vacancy defect in diamond is formed by a substitutional nitrogen next to a missing carbon in the diamond lattice. And in its negatively charged state, which is the state that most people study, there's 6 electrons that congregate around the potential well formed by this defect, acting very much like an atom bound in the crystal lattice. That's really a good way to think about it, because the electrons are very localized. In their ground state, these electrons have a net spin degree of freedom. It's a net spin s equals 1. And you can think about encoding information into those spin degrees of freedom. You'll note I've drawn here the 3 different spin sublevels, ms equals 0 and ms equals plus or minus 1. Now, this is 1 degree of freedom associated with the NV defect, but there's others as well, because in addition to the electronic spin, there's nuclear spins in the surrounding lattice. In particular, the host nitrogen has a nuclear spin, I equals 1, and 1% of the lattice sites in the surrounding diamond lattice are occupied by carbon 13, which has a spin 1/2. So each NV defect, in some ways, resembles a little NMR molecule, where you have a conglomeration of spins associated with each one. But unlike a typical NMR molecule, these defects have optical transitions that give you access to their spin degrees of freedom. The optical transitions of the NV center, actually, they're commonly excited using essentially just a green laser pointer. If you take a green laser pointer and you shine it at a diamond NV center, you're going to excite both the electronic transition and some vibrational degrees of freedom in the crystal. That is, you're exciting into the vibronic sideband. Those vibrations quickly decay, and the NV center then fluoresces in the red. And actually, if you've ever seen a pink diamond, the reason why it's pink is because it's got lots of these NV defect centers that are absorbing light from the room and fluorescing very weakly in the red. I've even seen diamonds that have so many of these defects in them, they're dark red like rubies. But getting back to the point, if you have diamonds that have very few NV defects, you can use these optical transitions to isolate individual ones. What you're seeing here is a scanning confocal microscope image, where we took a green laser, and if I can hold my hand steady enough, we scanned the green laser over the surface of the diamond and counted the number of red photons that come out at each point, so that each of those bright spots corresponds to an individual NV defect. So we can look at just one at a time. But more importantly, this same green laser pointer can be used to access the spins. In particular, when you shine a green laser pointer at an NV center, the amount of fluorescence that you get out initially depends on the spins projection in the ground state, whether it's ms equals 0 or ms equals plus or minus 1. And furthermore, if you keep shining that green laser at the NV defect, it'll polarize into one of the spin states. What this means is that you can use a very simple optical system to prepare and detect the state of an individual electronic spin in the solid state. And you can even do it at room temperature. And this is a really exciting opportunity. It's very difficult in general to measure single spins in solid state systems. And it's opened a host of opportunities because you're in the solid state, so you can also manipulate these spins on quite fast timescales. By fabricating strip lines or electrodes on the surface of the diamond, you can get into the regime where you're driving electron spin transitions on nanosecond timescales and nuclear spins on microseconds. And it's opened quite a number of applications, some of which I mentioned earlier. But the experiments that I worked on last year with Ronald Hansen at TU Delft were really fit into a particular vision for how to use the nitrogen vacancy center in diamond for quantum information science applications. And in particular, we think about using this collection of spins, the electronic and nuclear spins around a single NV defect, as a kind of quantum register, a few degrees of freedom into which we can encode information, that is, prepare them. We can manipulate their states, perform logical gates between them, and then read them out at the end of the computation. So it's like a small quantum computer over which we have complete control. And I should really emphasize that in the last few years, several groups around the world have demonstrated remarkable levels of coherent control over this multi-qubit system. With fast magnetic resonance-based gates between the electronic and nuclear spins, and extremely long coherence times. The gee whiz number here is that just this year, the Harvard group showed that at room temperature, you can look at a single nuclear spin near a diamond NV center and observe its quantum coherence persist over timescales measured in seconds. Room temperature solid. It's pretty impressive. And again, to be compared to the micro or nanosecond timescales of the gates. But even if you have excellent control over just a few spins, as I learned today, there's not really all that much interesting you can do with just a few quantum bits. You want for meaningful quantum information science applications to be able to scale it up. And there's a variety of ways to do this, but the one that I find the most compelling takes advantage of the optical transitions of the NV defect. Oh, and I should have mentioned, I should have studied my slides a little more. Actually, within that single register, people have even been able to demonstrate elementary quantum algorithms doing a Grover search with a couple of qubits. But to scale up, I'm interested in using the optical connections. And the idea is this. If you could come up with a mechanism by which to entangle the state of the spin with the polarization of an outgoing photon, and I should mention this was done a couple of years ago, then you have a connection between the spin over here and the photon over here. And if you can do that with another NV defect, so that this spin is entangled with this photon, and get the photons to interfere with each other on a beam splitter, then in effect you perform a connection at this point and can project the entanglement onto the distant NV spins. And once you have entanglement between two registers, you have a resource to perform quantum gates. And you can use it to build up your quantum network. So this is the vision. And the experiments that we performed fit into it in two different ways. The first set of experiments really focused in on this quantum register. And moving a bit away from coherent control, we focused on how well can you prepare and measure the quantum states of single spins associated with these defects. And the second set of experiments looked at quantum interference. Could we indeed see two-photon quantum interference between photons emitted by different NV defects? And so, I can now get to my outline, reading out spins and interfering photons. And let's get started. Okay, so if you've been listening for the last 10 minutes, you're probably wondering why this is a topic of research, because I just told you that the cool thing about NV centers is that you can read them out with a green laser pointer. But there's some caveats to this approach. In particular, the amount of spin polarization that you can obtain is not 100%. It's maybe 70, maybe 90%, depends on who you read. But worse, the amount of information that you get from the fluorescence is relatively minimal. It requires averaging over thousands, tens, or even hundreds of thousands of times to get enough signal to noise to reconstruct what the spin of the NV center is doing. And the little asterisk there is about a very cool experiment I'll tell you about in a few slides. And while there are some other approaches, when we started these experiments, it was an outstanding challenge to be able to prepare and detect with high fidelity the state of multiple spins associated with a defect. And this is really an important step towards quantum information applications. So to meet this challenge, what we did was to move from using green excitation to using red excitation, that is, to directly resonantly exciting the optical transitions of the NV center without involving any of these vibrational states. So let me start by saying a few more words about resonant excitation of an NV center. To resonantly excite the atomic-like transitions of the NV, you need to work at low temperatures so that you don't have too many phonons around. And if you take an NV center at low temperature and put it in its excited state and watch it fluoresce, the spectrum of photons that it emits looks a little bit like this. There's a really sharp line right at 637 nanometers that corresponds to the NV center just emitting a photon as it decays. And then this broad phonon sideband that extends out to about 800 nanometers that corresponds to emission of both a photon and a phonon. Now, For resonant excitation, what we care about is this zero phonon line that corresponds to the direct transitions. And if we take a laser and sweep it across that zero phonon line, while detecting how much fluorescence the NV center emits in the phonon sideband, we can tell when we hit the particular optical transitions of the NV. When we do this experiment, we see a series of sharp lines that correspond to transitions from individual spin states within the ground state of the NV center and the manifold of excited states. I'd like to draw your attention to a few properties of these transitions. The first is that the transitions are spin selective. For example, the two transitions that I've labeled here, F0 and F1, F0 can only occur if the electronic spin is in the state MS equals 0 when you start out, whereas the transition F1 can only be excited if the spin is in MS equals plus or minus 1. And actually, I'm going to talk about these transitions a little bit more, so let's zoom in on them and forget about the rest. Now, the second aspect of resonant excitation that I want to draw out is that the transitions are mostly spin conserving. That is, I've tried to illustrate with these dashed lines here that when you excite an NV center from MS equals 0 in the F0 transition, most of the time it decays back to MS equals 0 and the spin doesn't flip. And these two properties are what allow us to borrow some established techniques from atomic physics to perform single-shot readout and high-fidelity preparation of the spins. In particular, because the transitions don't entirely conserve spin, we can borrow optical pumping from atomic physics to prepare their states. It's a very simple idea that's been used in many experiments, namely that if I were to start off with my NV center in an unknown spin state, MS equals 0 or MS equals plus or minus 1, and apply light on the F1 transition, then if it starts off in MS equals 0, nothing happens, and if it starts off in MS equals plus or minus 1, it'll optically cycle till the spin flips and it ends up in MS equals 0. So no matter where you start, you end up in MS equals 0. And the signal that you see corresponding to this is an exponential decay in fluorescence. Similarly, you can apply light on the F0 transition to optically pump the spin into MS equals plus or minus 1. And by comparing the initial and final values of these fluorescence curves, we can ascertain that we prepare the spin state into MS equals 0 with 99.6% fidelity, which is more than an order of magnitude improvement over previous methods. But I want to draw your attention to another aspect of this data, which is the x-axis of these graphs. It takes a fairly long time for the spin to flip as we excite and the NV fluoresces, excite, fluoresce, excite, fluoresce. In particular, it takes 10 or 20 microseconds for a spin flip to occur, which is much longer than the 12 nanosecond optically excited lifetime of the NV center. So the NV should be undergoing hundreds of optical cycles before the spin flips. And that is our readout mechanism. Borrowing established atomic physics or ion trap experiment techniques, if we want to know whether the spin is in MS equals 0 or MS equals plus or minus 1, all we should have to do is turn on light resonant with the F0 transition. If it's in the state MS equals 0, then the NV should emit lots of photons. If it's in the state MS equals plus or minus 1, it shouldn't emit any. And our experimental challenge is just whether or not we can collect enough of those photons to distinguish the spin states before they flip. Now, to meet that challenge, the graduate student I was working with, Hannes Bernin, helped to develop some techniques to fabricate solid immersion lenses into the diamond that we were working with. He selected out an NV center that had nice properties and then used a focused ion beam to etch a hemisphere into the diamond. This is a scanning electron microscope image of our diamond. And right at the middle of that hemisphere is an NV center, which you can see in the fluorescence image. The things on the sides here are electrodes and gates that we use to apply microwaves. So using these microfabricated solid immersion lenses, we can improve the collection efficiency by an order of magnitude and indeed get into the regime where it's possible to measure the spin. So let me show you some data. Experimentally, we start by using optical pumping to prepare a spin state. For example, we might optically pump into the state MS equals 0 before applying a spin readout on the F0 transition. What we see if we optically pump into MS equals 0 first is that we can get lots of photons out of the system, on average about 6 before the spin flips. If we were to perform the same readout after optically pumping into MS equals plus or minus 1, we see less than a tenth of a photon. This is a really good signal to noise in a measurement, and it corresponds to a single shot detection fidelity of better than 93%. And actually, in more recent data, they've been able to push this to 95 or 96%. Now, a reasonable question to ask is whether or not we're actually measuring the spin here. And so to confirm that, we performed an experiment. We prepared the spin and then rotated it a controllable amount. That is, we sent in a pulse that was resonant with the spin transition. And at the end of... That's happening on its own. There we go. At the end of each microwave pulse, performed our readout. Now, this is a single-shot readout that seems to have a mind of its own. And so at the end of every readout, we always get a digital answer. It's either in this spin state or that spin state. But if we average over thousands of these measurements, then we can reconstruct the Rabi oscillations that we would expect to see from driving the spin mutations and confirm that we are indeed measuring the spin states of BNB. Okay. So we have a quantum measurement. And the next question that you might ask is, how ideal is this quantum measurement? Is this the ideal quantum non-demolition measurement that you read about in your quantum mechanics textbooks? Well, no. What we're doing to read out the spin is also exactly the same thing that we do to prepare the spin, to optically pump it. So in the process of measuring the spin, we destroy its state. But if we make the readout shorter, then it's less likely that a spin flip will recur. You remember there's that long exponential tail to the fluorescence decay under F0 excitation. And so in the limit of a very, very short readout duration, well, let's think about what happens. Suppose we start off with a spin superposition and we send in a really, really short readout pulse, 400 nanoseconds. It's so short that almost certainly, experimentally, we're not going to detect any photons. And when that happens, we learn nothing about what's going on. But if we do get a photon, then we can be reasonably certain that within the first dozen nanoseconds of this readout pulse, the spin superposition was projected onto the state MS equals zero. And furthermore, because the readout pulse is short, it's probably still in the state MS equals zero. And so even though our measurement isn't ideal, we can still use it for probabilistic measurement-based quantum state preparation. That is, by making our readout shorter and shorter and shorter and conditioning on getting a photon, we can prepare into the spin state MS equals zero with a fidelity approaching that which we can obtain by optical pumping. And this is interesting, because the electronic spin isn't alone. It has nuclear spins around. And if you think about it, if you can entangle your electronic spin that you can measure with nuclear spins that you can't, when you measure that electron spin, you project the spins you otherwise couldn't talk to onto the associated state. So let me show you how this works in a very simple scenario. The simplest possible thing you could do to your nuclear spin would be to prepare it in a well-defined state. And the simplest possible system we could talk about would be the electronic spin at the NB center talking to the host nitrogen nuclear spin. Now, forgive me here. I'm going to draw some spin sublevels, but it's so I can walk you through what we actually do. The spin sublevels that we're talking about are the electron spin MS equals 0, MS equals minus 1, and I put MS equals plus 1 over here so you don't have to worry about it. And then the nuclear spin within each of those electron spin manifolds can point in one of three directions because it's an I equals 1 nuclear spin. Now, we start off, even at 9 Kelvin, in a thermal distribution that's essentially equally populated among all of these spin levels. And what we want to do is to prepare the nuclear spin state. We start by optically pumping the electronic spin into the MS equals minus 1 state. And now we want to introduce some correlations between the electronic and nuclear spin degrees of freedom, so that measuring the electron spin will tell us something about the nuclear spin. We do that by taking advantage of the hyperfine interaction to be able to drive the electron spin flip with microwaves only for one of the three nuclear spin projections. So that if we then send in a short readout pulse, well, okay, it's a short readout pulse. So almost all the time we won't get any photons out, we won't learn anything about the system, and we'll have to start over. But if we do get a photon, we know the electron spin is in MS equals zero, and the nuclear spin must be spin down. And we can see this in our data. We start off without any kind of preparation with a series of hyperfine lines. And if those words don't mean anything to you, what you need to know is that the outer two-most resonances correspond to the nuclear spin down state. And if we apply the preparation, those, in fact, are the only transitions we see. So we're able to prepare the nuclear spin state by measurement. And this can be extended to much more complicated experiments, for example, larger numbers of nuclear spins. We did an experiment where we were able to prepare the electronic spin and three nearby nuclear spins by measurement into one of 36 possible configurations. So just to recap, what I've told you about so far are a series of preparation and measurement techniques for spins and diamond. I told you about how to prepare an electronic spin, how to read out that electronic spin, and how to prepare nuclear spins. So there's an obvious fourth experiment I should tell you about, which is how to read out the nuclear spins. Well, the idea is very simple. If I have an electron spin that I can measure and a nuclear spin that I want to know, and I can get them to interact, I should just map the nuclear spin onto the electron spin and measure it. But there's a subtlety here, so I'd like to walk you through what we actually do. Let's say we wanted to read out the state of the nitrogen nuclear spin. And we started off in some unknown combination of electronic and nuclear spin states. We'd begin by optically pumping the electronic spin, and then, as before, correlating the electronic and nuclear spin degrees of freedom. So that when we read out the electron spin, and here this is a full readout, so if we don't get any photons out, we'd expect the electron spin to be an ns equals minus 1, or the nuclear spin down. Whereas if we do get photons out, we know the nuclear spin had to be in 0 or plus 1. And the subtlety is this. While the readout does destroy the electron spin information, it doesn't necessarily flip the nuclear spin. So we can repeat it to get better signal to noise. This idea was first recognized by the Harvard group in 2009 and later used by the Stuttgart group in 2010 in conjunction with a conventional green excitation to achieve single-shot detection of a nuclear spin with 92% fidelity. By working with resonant excitation, we were able to achieve the same fidelity with only 3 repetitions. And furthermore, more importantly, we were able to do it in a manner that was compatible with reading out more than just one spin. So I'd like to finish this section of the talk by telling you about an experiment that really puts together all of the components I just talked about. This experiment began by using measurement-based state preparation to initialize a 2-qubit register formed by the electronic and nuclear spin degrees of freedom. We then drove controlled rotations of these spins, driving the electron spin and then the nuclear spin, before reading out in a single shot, first the electron spin and then the nuclear spin. And what we saw as a function of the rotation angles of the spin is that the electron spin state only depends on the duration of the microwave pulse that are resonant with the electron spin transition, while the nuclear spin state only depends on the RF pulse duration, that is, what's driving the nuclear spin, indicating that we do indeed have a single-shot mechanism for detecting the state of 2 coupled spin qubits. Okay. So that's about what I wanted to say about reading out and preparing spins. And in my remaining time, I think it's about 20 minutes, I'd like to talk about the next set of experiments that we did, which are centered around 2-photon quantum interference. Now, for those of you who haven't thought about 2-photon quantum interference in a while, it's this crazy effect where if 2 identical photons encounter each other on a 50-50 beam splitter such that they emerge from they're matched in spatial mode, these 2 photons will always come out together. Now, why does this happen? Well, it happens because of an interference effect. If you think about the 2 ways by which the photons can emerge from different ports, they could either both reflect or both transmit. And the laws of unitarity conspire such that any 50-50 beam splitter will always have a minus sign between the amplitudes for those 2 paths. So if the photons are indistinguishable, and we have to sum the amplitudes before we calculate the other probabilities, well, then they're going to be complete destructive interference between these 2 paths, and the photons cannot emerge from the different ports. experimentally, what we hope to see is that when two identical photons encounter each other on a beam splitter, they always emerge together. It's kind of romantic. But it's also kind of useful, because ultimately this is the mechanism by which one might hope to create optical channels between distant NB centers. So we want to see two-photon quantum interference, which means that we want to get two different NB centers to emit indistinguishable photons, that is, photons that have the same polarization, the same timing, the same spatial mode on the beam splitter, and the same frequency. And it turns out that this last portion, the same frequency, is relatively difficult to do in the solid state. You might recall that the fluorescence spectrum of the NB is extremely broad. So if we want to have any hope of getting indistinguishable photons from two different NBs, we're going to have to spectrally filter out the zero phonon line, which I've labeled the good stuff. But even within that zero phonon line, there's still all of the fine structure of the NB center, the many different resonant optical transitions that I talked about before. Fortunately, over the last 5 years or so, the NB community has developed a fairly sophisticated understanding of the structure of the defect, such that we actually know what each of these transitions corresponds to. For example, we know that these two transitions can only happen if the electron spin starts out in the state MS equals zero. So if we can optically pump the spin into MS equals zero, then we can only have to deal with these two transitions. And furthermore, they happen to be orthogonally polarized. So we have a recipe for isolating a single transition within the zero phonon line. We need to spectrally filter out the zero phonon line. We need to pump the spin into the MS equals zero state. And then we need to use polarization filtering to isolate just that single transition. All right, so this should work. But there's always some caveats when you're working with solid state devices. And the two most important caveats here involve inhomogeneity between NB centers and spectral diffusion in time. Every NB center lives in a different portion of the crystal. It has different strain, different local electric fields, and those lead to shifts in the resonant transitions of the defect. So the two different NB centers will have slightly different emission frequencies, even if we isolate the same type of transition. Worse, even for a single NB center, we see spectral diffusion in time on the transitions. This is a plot where you can see the transition of a single NB center wandering around in time over hundreds of megahertz. It takes about a millisecond or two for a scan, so that gives you a sense of the time scale. So we're going to have to cope with both of these effects to be able to observe a two-photon quantum interference. Well, to deal with inhomogeneity between NB centers, we have a couple of options. One is to take advantage of the fact that local electric fields affect the transition frequencies of the NB defect and actually use gate electrodes to apply a controllable DC Stark shift and tune them into resonance. We fabricated samples where we had two NB centers, each in their own solid immersion lens, with gates labeled G1 and G2 that we could use to apply a voltage to the defects and shift their transitions into resonance with each other. But as it turns out, this isn't the technique that we used. We went with a time-honored method that's employed in labs around the world to solve all kinds of problems. We got lucky and managed to find an NV center, or a pair of NV centers, where the two transitions exactly overlapped. And so we could just apply our recipe here. We could isolate the ZPL, spin pump into MS equals zero, and polarization filter, so that each of our NB centers should be emitting photons with exactly the same frequency. To check that, we sent the emission through a Fabry-Perot filter and looked at the spectrum of the emission, and we could indeed verify that the two emission frequencies were essentially on top of each other. We'd solved the inhomogeneity problem by getting lucky. But we still have to deal with spectral diffusion in time. If you look at these emission spectra, you'll notice that the line width is extremely broad. It's about 500 megahertz or so, which is much, much larger than what you would expect for an emitter with a 12 nanosecond lifetime. It should be like 15 megahertz. And so a cartoon of what's happening while we take these emission spectra is that each NV center is emitting a very narrow band of photons at a given instant in time, but they're wandering around. And so when we perform our interference experiments, at any given point, it's quite likely that the two NV centers are actually emitting photons with different frequencies. So we're going to have to cope with this somehow. To cope with spectral diffusion, it's helpful to go back to the original explanation that I gave you about what two-photon quantum interference is. I'd said that if we had indistinguishable photons, then we would get destructive interference, and the two photons couldn't emerge from different ports. They'd have to come out together. But really, the interference isn't between the photons. It's between the paths, which means that it doesn't really matter whether the photons are in principle distinguishable. What matters is whether or not our detectors can distinguish these paths. And so we can exploit the intrinsic time resolution of our detectors to erase the frequency difference information of the photons and recover two-photon quantum interference. That's quite a mouthful. Don't worry, I'm going to explain what that means. In fact, I want to walk you through the experiment that we did to make it clear what I mean by time resolution. So experimentally, we have two NV centers plus some filters to isolate that individual transition. And we excite them with a picosecond pulse of green light. Now, most of the time, the NV centers emit photons that don't get through the filters or aren't collected by our optics, and we have to start over again. Every once in a while, we might get one click, but those photons never even had a chance to interact. So experimentally, the only data that we take is when both NV centers emit photons that get through the filters, encounter each other on the beam splitter, and lead to two clicks. Click, click, one in each detector. And so experimentally, what we record is the number of these double clicks, or coincidence counts, as a function of the time between them. That's where the time resolution comes in. And if we can histogram the number of these coincidence clicks as a function of that time with good enough time resolution, then within that tau equals zero bin, the two detectors simply don't have enough time to, in principle, distinguish the frequency difference of the photons. And we should recover two-photon quantum interference. Now, this is true, but I find it really unsatisfying. So let's rewind to that moment when the two photons were about to hit the beam splitter and think really carefully about what's going on. We know that we have one photon in each of the input ports, possibly of different frequencies. And so we can write down our initial state, one photon in each input port. Now, what we care about is what we measure on the output ports of the beam splitter, which are related to the input ports by the beam splitter relations up to some factors of square root of 2. So for sake of argument, let's suppose that the first detector to go click is the one on output port 4. Click. In that detection event, the instant that happens, the detector annihilates a photon in mode 4. And that annihilation of the photon projects the remaining photon onto a superposition state of the two input ports. And the interesting thing is that the superposition state that that annihilation projects the photon onto is precisely the superposition state that always interferes with itself to emerge on the same output port. And so what if what we're measuring experimentally is the probability to detect a photon on the other output port? Well, immediately after that first click, it's just not possible. That will change with time, though, if these two modes have different frequencies, because that superposition state will evolve as the frequency difference between the two photons, and as a result, the probability to see a photon at output port 3 should oscillate in time. So I would expect that our coincidence counts should look something like this. We should see oscillations that follow the frequency difference of the incoming photons. Of course, this is what we would see if we had incoming photons of different frequencies. But that's not what we have experimentally. We have incoming photons with different fluctuating frequencies. So sometimes we might be sampling data from a distribution that looks like this, sometimes with a different frequency difference, different interference fringes, from a distribution that looks like that, sometimes like that. And when we average over all of the possibilities, the interference fringes wash out, and all we're left with is a characteristic suppression of coincidence events right at tau equals zero. And that's our characteristic hallmark of two-photon quantum interference. So this is what we hope to see. And this is what we saw. What you see on the top is the repetition rate of our pulsed laser at 10 megahertz. And when you zoom in right around tau equals zero, you do indeed see that our coincidence counts are suppressed with about 66% visibility. And furthermore, we have a very good understanding of our system. The red line is a zero-free parameter simulation from independently measured quantities. Moreover, we can also do a control experiment where we purposefully make the photons distinguishable by rotating their wave plate in front of one of the input ports and making their polarization perpendicular. And that, in that case, the two-photon quantum interference effect disappears. So we really have a clear qualitative signature of two-photon quantum interference between photons emitted by different NV centers. Now, we did our experiments on NV centers in a single diamond in the same cryostat. They're maybe 10 or 20 microns apart. And actually, a few months after we got these results, the Harvard group was able to get similar results using NV centers in cryostats on either side of a laboratory. So really, the community is trying to move towards establishing optical channels over macroscopic distances. Now, these are initial experiments. And if we want to move towards more realistic demonstrations, there are a number of things that we're going to need to improve. And so in my last few minutes, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the areas that the community is working on now. One area that we're working on is eliminating luck. Both the Delft experiments that I worked on and the Harvard experiments got lucky in finding NV centers whose emission lines just happened to overlap. And the reason isn't because they couldn't tune electrically. The reason is because it's very tricky to keep the electrical tuning stable when you have photo-excited carriers in the diamond as well as voltages around. We actually tried. We used our NV centers tuned onto resonance and looked for two-photon quantum interference. And we saw it, kind of, we think. It's really bad. And the reason is that you can see this red line is a simulation that followed the frequency drifts in our system during the electronic tuning. So the spectral diffusion got much, much worse for us. And I think moving forward, we're going to need to develop a better understanding of how to tune transitions in the presence of photo-excited carriers, and possibly even how to stabilize lines. Actually, this was just done. The HP group used electrodes to feed back on the frequency of the NV emission and stabilize it. So what you're seeing on top is the emission frequency of an NV center that isn't stabilized, and on the bottom with feedback from electrodes. So this is an area of active research for the field. But the other area that I think is really critical for establishing optical connections between defect centers is figuring out how to get more photons out of them. I said when I talked about these two-photon quantum interference experiments that most of the time we didn't get a photon, we didn't get double clicks. I didn't tell you how many tries we had to do in order to get a coincidence count. We only got coincidence counts every one out of every 10 million attempts. So this is a very low probability of success. And to increase it, we need to improve both the overall collection efficiency and we want to improve the number of photons emitted on the zero phonon line, the coherent portion of the emission. Now, our experiments used solid immersion lenses, and there are other techniques that use, for example, micropillars to help to direct the emission where your collection optics are. But these can really only increase the overall collection efficiency. They can't improve the amount of photons that are emitted into the zero phonon line. And moving forward, one of the things the community is actively working on is to try to incorporate NV centers not just into optical structures, but into resonant cavities, where you can take advantage of cavity quantum electrodynamics effects, in particular Purcell enhancement, to increase the spontaneous emission on the zero phonon line and essentially enhance the number of photons, of coherent photons, that the NV center emits. Just to give you some last pretty pictures, there's several groups who are working on this to develop nanophotonics in diamond, where they have ring resonators in this case, or photonic crystal cavities with very high quality factors at low mode volumes that should be able to provide this kind of enhancement. And I think the state of the art is that in a cavity that looks like this, the HP Labs group was able to see a Purcell enhancement of about 70 for a single NV center emitter. Okay, so I hope that I've given you some picture over the last 45 or 50 minutes of the kind of research that I'm doing and the kind of things that the field is interested in establishing both control over NV defects and their nearby nuclear spins, and figuring out mechanisms to establish optical connections for scaling them up to larger devices. And while there's lots of things that we need to do, we need higher fidelity, we need better spin-photon entanglement, we really need to improve this collection efficiency, there's a number of different techniques that the community is taking to solve these problems. And I really think that in the next few years, you'll see some demonstrations of entanglement distribution between NV defects over long distances. So let me thank all of the people and places that need to be thanked, especially Bates and TU Delft, who supported the work I told you about today. Lucio Robledo and Hannes Bernin were the postdoc and the graduate student that I worked with in Ronald Hansen's group, and Ronald Hansen deserves a special thanks for involving me in this research. I'm currently at Yale working with Jack Harris, and in January I'll be moving to McGill. And with that, thank you very much for your attention.